Obadiah is near the end of the Old Testament. It is, for those of you that have been in sessions this week, most of the week has been spent on Amos. It's the book after Amos. It's the shortest book in the Old Testament. And I had originally intended to talk about Habakkuk, which is another one of everybody's all-time favorites. And my wife was involved in a Bible study last fall at church, and they spent an overlong time on Habakkuk, and she said, "Oh, don't do Habakkuk." So I said, "All right, I'll do Obadiah." I teach a group of eighth graders on Sundays at our home church, and for the last 2 years I have been doing a series with them that I call the Little Books of the Bible. Any book of the Bible that in the King James Version is 4 pages or less long is a little book. And we do 17 books of the Bible in one Sunday school year, you know, and so that's slightly more than one quarter of the Bible in terms of numbers of books. It's not that many pages, but it gives them a feeling of achievement if on a given Sunday they have read an entire book of the Bible, like Obadiah, you know, or 2 John or 3 John or something like that. So it's kind of fun, and it does take you all over the place. There are more little books in the New Testament than in the Old Testament, and so you can't just do old, new, old, new, old, new, you know, on your series of topics. But you can for the most part, and they get an interesting capsule view of the great variety of kinds of literature that you have in the Bible, as well as a great deal of Bible history. So if any of you are Sunday school teachers and looking for an idea of something to do sometime, there's one free of charge. Okay, Obadiah. I'm going to have to give you some history, and I'm going to have to give you some geography. Because Obadiah is about Edom, E-D-O-M. And if you don't know, I should show you where Edom was and something about the history of the Edomites. First of all, let me say something about Obadiah. The word Obadiah means servant of Yahweh, servant of the Lord. It occurs 9 times in the Old Testament, and it refers, and it's used as the name of 9 different people. Most scholars think that Obadiah, the author of this book, is someone different than all the other Obadiahs that are mentioned in the Old Testament. And of course, there's always the possibility that the word Obadiah was used, you know, as a technical expression rather than as the man's name. In other words, this book is written by a servant of the Lord. See. But most scholars think that Obadiah was the guy's real name.
Close that door. The smoke is already coming
out. Maybe that's our problem. Okay. So most scholars think that this is the actual name of the author. His name was Obadiah, and that he is not any of the other Obadiahs that are mentioned in the Old Testament. It is obvious from the text that he is very angry with Edom, because Edom fought on the side of Babylon against the kingdom of Judah, as a result of which the kingdom of Judah was conquered. Most of the people were taken into captivity at Babylon, 586. And this is written after that time, and is telling the people from Edom, you're going to get yours because you were on the other side. Jim suggested to me this morning that maybe this one is a kind of an analog to our feelings about somebody rather after Vietnam. But anyway, it's written by Obadiah. He is a Jew from Judah somewhere, at least from the kingdom of Judah. And it is a It is a criticism and it is a prophecy about the downfall of Edom, because they fought on the side of Babylonia against the Jews. Okay, now, I kind of drew a sort of map up here. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. This is Asia Minor. Today is Turkey. Down here is Palestine. Here's the Dead Sea. I'm going to put down a little lower. And there's the Sea of Galilee. This little thing sticking out here is Mount Carmel. I always tell Mount Carmel, you know, because if you take a piece of caramel and pull on it, and it comes out like that, so Mount Carmel is right up there. Up here is the Tyre and Sidon are. This isn't quite accurate here, but here's the Mesopotamia area, and right about here is the capital of Babylonia, Babylon, Persian Gulf down here. Here's the Red Sea, Nile River, Egypt. This is the Gulf of Aqaba, over which the 1957 war started. Edom was this territory here. The Edomites lived in the caves and heights on both sides of the Gulf of Aqaba, and also in this territory here, and then in the low flatlands south of the Dead Sea. The Babylonians came around this way, conquered the Syrians, came down along the coastal plain, conquered the Egyptians, and then they signed a peace treaty with the Kingdom of Judah. The Kingdom of Israel was long since wiped out by the Assyrians, who had been in this area here. They were wiped out by the Babylonians. All right, Babylonians came down here. They took the king of Judah into captivity to Babylon, put their own puppet king in Jerusalem to rule over the kingdom. That was roughly about 600 BC. After a few years, and he led a revolt against the Babylonians. They were crushed. And then a great mass of people were taken into captivity into Babylonia, and some people were resettled down in here from outlying areas in order to de-Jewify it, in other words, to change the nature of the people that were living here, much as the Jews have done with the Jewish state since they got a Jewish state. And more and more Jews have moved in there and settled the area, and the Arabs have moved out. The Edomites fought on the side of the Babylonians, and as the Babylonians pressed in this way on the kingdom of Judah, they attempted to flee to the south and to escape out this way, and Edomites blocked their escape, and so they got caught in a pincers movement here, and that's one of the primary reasons why they did lose that at that time, and why the king was captured. So there was good reason to be angry with Edomites for having fought on the side of the Babylonians, because they cut off the escape hatch to get out this way and get away from the Babylonians. Okay, who were the Edomites? The Edomites were the descendants of Esau, who was Jacob's twin brother and born before Jacob, and so the legitimate heir to the promise. But you remember how Jacob, with the help of Mama, conned him out of the birthright, and then was forced to flee from the ancestral home to escape the wrath of his brother Esau. We don't hear anything about the descendants of Esau to amount to anything until the Israelites leave Egypt, and then they come across the southern area of the Mediterranean, and they're going to head up into Canaan, and their way is blocked by Edom. So they send ambassadors to the king of Edom, and they say, hi, relatives, how you doing? You know, we'd sort of like to go through. We're on the way to Canaan, you know. Remember Esau and Jacob and all that, you know. We're relatives, and relatives should be nice to one another, and could we please have safe conduct through your land? And the response of the Edomites is, in a pig's ear you can have safe conduct through our land. We aren't about to have a bunch of riffraff slaves wandering through here, you know, and you boys have got a reputation for stealing and everything else, and you'll just have to go around. And so they force them to head down south and swing way off to the east and then come in by way of Jericho instead of the easy way up through the south, which endeared them no end to the Jews. And from that time on, there was a great deal of hostility back and forth between them, but the Jews never did make any efforts to wipe them out, as they did with many other of the Canaanite tribes, you know, to kill them, men, women, and child, and so remove them as a threat. King Saul fought against the Edomites. At the time of the first kings, most of the problems which children of Israel had were down in the south. They had trouble with the Philistines, and they had trouble with the Edomites. Problems to the north didn't seem to exist at that time, and really didn't develop until later on as Syria got to be more powerful. So they fought with the Philistines, who had cities built over by the coast in the lowlands and the lush farm country, and they fought with the Edomites, who had the foothills and the mountains and the area around the Gulf of Aqaba. Well, Saul fought with them and wasn't particularly successful. David fought with them and conquered them. David was a great warrior king who conquered all of the opposition and who established the Jewish state as a world empire. Solomon apparently then exploited the Edomite people because he sent engineers and surveyors down in this Gulf of Aqaba territory, and they discovered iron down there, they discovered copper down there, and they discovered some gold down there, and that's the location of King Solomon's mines. He, down at the very end of the Gulf, he established a city which still exists today, a city called Ezion Geber. And it was built to smelt the ore which they got from the mines along the Gulf, and also to engage in some metal manufacture, making copper pots and tools and things like that, and various kinds of iron instruments. And it got to be quite an important and significant city. That was all Edom territory. Well, the Edomites somehow or other managed to survive, and they managed to maintain their own religion until about 200 B.C. And about 200 B.C., which is the time of the Maccabees, there's a resurgence of Jewish nationalistic feeling, and under Judas Maccabeus, they establish a Jewish free state for a short period of time. One of the things which happened at that time was Judas Maccabeus, for the final time, conquered the Edomites. And at that time, he forced the males all to be circumcised, and he made the Jewish religion the only permissible religion, and the Edomites disappeared as a distinct culture. And they reoccur only once more in history, in a fascinating and ironic kind of way, because they were limited to this particular area right here. They had been driven out of the heights here because of all of the mineral wealth there, and after the Jews lost it, then other countries took over the mineral area. So they were in this little area south of the Dead Sea, foothills and flat area, which was called Idumea. Idumea. And a family came from Idumea and became rulers over the Jews, and that was the Herodian family. So Herod the Great was an Edomite. He was an Edomite of blood. And then his sons who ruled the general area there. And then Herod, who ruled Galilee at the time that Jesus was executed, they were Edomites. So, and then after them came the downfall of the Jewish state, and the Romans got tired of those regular rebellions of the Jews against Roman rule and pretty well wiped them out as an effective political force until after World War II. So the last great surge of Jewish power was led by a couple of Edomite kings, the Herods. Okay, and they were at the time of Christ. So you can see the hostility which was between the descendants of Esau and the descendants of Jacob continued throughout their history. Let's see. In 586, as I mentioned, they were on the sides of the Babylonians. After the Jews were removed from Judea, the Edomites moved into the territory and occupied it and ran it for a while, with the result that when the Jews began to come back from the Babylonian captivity, they had to contend with the Edomites, who had taken over the territory, and to force them back out once again. So it was a kind of an unhappy peace between them. At the same time, life hadn't been too thrilling and exciting for the Edomites, because the Edomites were always under pressure from over here. And who lived over there? The same kind of people as live there today, the Arabs. And so the Arabs were always pushing out of the desert off to the west to try to get over toward those fertile farmlands on the coast and to get what they could. The Arabs were nomadic, drifting people, and when life got difficult, they would raid the Edomite settlements for food. And so, you know, the Edomites kind of found themselves sitting in the middle also. Nobody really had a nice time of it, because there's always pressure from one side or another. And it was very difficult for a country to maintain its freedom and its autonomy, because there were so many different groups trying to dominate the same territory, and none of the groups were really economically self-sufficient, and so they constantly had either trade with one another or conquer one another in order to survive. So the Edomites were always under pressure against the Arabs, and it was the Arabs who weakened them sufficiently that the Jews were then able to conquer them at the time of Judas Maccabeus. Okay, most of the book is hatred expressed toward the Edomites. Some of the verses show strong similarities to most of the verses of Jeremiah chapter 49. With the result that many scholars think that Jeremiah copied some lines from Obadiah, which would mean that the book of Obadiah existed before the book of Jeremiah did. Although there are some that think that Jeremiah's writing and Obadiah's writing are contemporaneous to one another, and that maybe both of them borrowed from a hate poem which somebody else wrote, you know, which is not extant, that they both copied from the same source. But all right, there is a similarity of thought, and it's obvious that there is a relationship. The primary thought of the book of Obadiah is God will sit in moral judgment on the nations of the world. It's an interesting thought. You'll find it in some other parts of the Old Testament also. But the primary emphasis is that the world of international politics is not an ethically neutral world. it makes a difference the way a nation operates. And if a nation is immoral in its activity, sooner or later it will pay the consequences for what it has done, and in some way or other God will act in judgment and bring about either the punishment or the destruction of that nation. Obadiah saw it in the in what happened, first of all, to his own country. His own country was destroyed because it had not been faithful to the covenant with God. At the same time, Edom will be destroyed because it fought against God's chosen people. And it fought against blood relatives. Granted, kind of thin blood, since they were half-brothers. No, I take it back. They were not half-brothers. I was thinking of Isaac and the Abraham situation with the legitimate son and the illegitimate son. No, Jacob and Esau were full brothers. And so because they fought against their blood brothers, instead of supporting them, they are going to be punished and destroyed. I suspect that at the time when Obadiah was living, that it was very easy to have that kind of feeling, because within a relatively short period of time, certainly within a period of time that the historians could have kept record of, Syria had risen, become a world power, and been destroyed. Assyria had risen, become a world power, and been destroyed. Babylonia had arisen and was now a world power, and would probably be destroyed. And so, as you saw, one nation after another rise up, control the whole area, appear completely invincible, and then just like that, wiped out. You begin to have very little confidence in the force of man and the weapons and manpower of human armies. And you begin to have a feeling that somehow or other the hand of God is operative in history, and God brings down the mighty and protects the weak. And so Obadiah has an oracle. Now, whether this is to be taken literally, that a vision came to him and he is now reporting the vision, or were they simply using this as metaphorical language to say, I have a message from God to the people of Edom. Your turn is next. You're going to get it. We don't know. Can be interpreted either kind of way. But he is seeing the hand of God in the destruction of the kingdom of Judah. And he is seeing the hand of God in what he sees as the forthcoming destruction of the kingdom of Edom. There are a number of the prophets who make a great deal, not only of this point, but also a great deal of the point of not trusting in diplomatic alliances. Probably for a period of about 200 years, diplomacy was an extremely important activity on the part of the kings of the north and then the kings of the south. And for a while, the king of the south tended to be a better diplomat than the king of the north, with the result that ultimately the king of the north, the king of Israel, and his people are conquered and destroyed, whereas Judah seems to survive for a while longer. Isaiah complains about their depending on weak alliances rather than on the hand of God, and Jeremiah complains about this also, as do many of the minor prophets who come before the exile. And they are constantly saying, you know, the best army isn't necessarily the best defense. The best defense is to be on the side of God. We were kind of reminded of that a bit the early part of World War II. You remember the story that went around that Hitler advised Mussolini to do something in Italy that was going to affect the few papal holdings that were left. And Mussolini was a bit concerned about doing it and said to Hitler, well, I don't think the Pope will like it if I do that. And Hitler's response was, how many legions does the Pope have? How many divisions? No, legions is old Roman term. How many divisions does the Pope have? Now, whereupon Mussolini went ahead and did it. Yeah, the Pope and the Papal State are still around, and Hitler and Mussolini are gone.
The Pope rebutted to that in a muffled voice. He says, he will learn my legions when he meets his divine judgment.
That I didn't know, Jim. Thanks. Okay. So, all right, the from a political standpoint, the Papal State survived, and Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy didn't. And so I suspect there's a lesson there for diplomats and army generals that they aren't necessarily the final voice on how nations should operate. But there's another theme that's in Obadiah, and this is Obadiah in the latter part of the book has a messianic prophecy, as so many of the other prophets do. It's not very specific. He talks about it in terms of the restoration of Mount Zion, the sacred hill. And this is about as specific as he gets. But he holds up the hope. And he holds up the hope in the day when there no longer exists a Jewish state, when all of the wealthy people and the intelligent people and the professional people have been carted off to Babylonia, and all that's left is the riffraff of the Jews and the criminals and the juvenile delinquents and a few farmers, and that's all that's left. The cream of the culture are carted lock, stock, and barrel off to Babylonia. And it's in this day that Obadiah says the promise of God will be kept. And I suspect those last verses are the most important ones in the book. Because it's not very hard, you know, in the heat of anger when you've been defeated to speak curses on your enemy. Easiest thing in the world. And that's what goes on in the early part of the book. But the hard thing is to keep on believing in the promise, which comes at the end of the book. When you get done with it, you might say, well, now, why did this book ever make it into the Old Testament canon? Why is it still there? Nobody reads it. You know, except us this morning. And why should one? There aren't any, you know, beautiful prophecy passages, you know, like, but thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be small among the cities of Judah, and so on. You know, there's nothing like that in Obadiah. When you think back to your confirmation instruction, I don't think there's a single passage from Obadiah that you had to memorize, which may endear the book to you. You know, you didn't have to memorize any of it. But there's nothing from Obadiah. Well, what's it doing in the Old Testament? I suspect because it... Well, at the time, I expect they kept it because maybe Obadiah did a better job of cursing the enemies than anybody else did. But, you know, that was the temporary value of the book. But after the restoration of the kingdom, it was lovely poetry. It was done beautifully. Did some rather good lines in pentameter. Most of the lines are five-footed lines, just rather unusual for Jewish poetry. But apart from that, it is another book of the promise. And probably it was a message which was very comforting, both to the Jewish people in captivity and the Jewish people in Palestine in their darkest hour. Sort of like the speeches of Winston Churchill for the British people at the time of the Battle of Britain, when the German bombers were dropping bombs and then the rockets were coming over, and Britain was, you know, looked like she was on her knees and about to go under, you know, and the speeches of Winston Churchill were extremely important. I suspect that the book of Obadiah probably had this same kind of importance for the Jewish people in their darkest hour. And then afterwards, they became more aware of the last verses and the promise. The promise which was still there, even though it didn't look like anything could ever happen good for the Jewish people again. Yes, sir.
I'm reminded of a story of the bully that packs off one little boy, and while he's doing it, the other little boy hits the one that he's packing over the head with a club, and he looks up at him and says, "Well, when Daddy gets home, you're going to get yours."
Right. That's right. Yeah. And that's the general kind of thought of Obadiah. You know, it's said in beautiful poetic lines with some nice imagery, but it's the same point. Sure. You're going to get yours. God isn't going to let that one get by, especially since you did it to a relative. Okay. Let's see if I've got any other thoughts.
I'd like to make a comment, too.
Sure.
Yeah. Obviously, we always want to end with the promise and run to the promise.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I think we either don't know how to cope with or are scared to look at or don't want to face the reality of the judgment of God, this whole concept of holy wrath, which at certain points in life each of us needs to hear.
Oh, yeah. And also on a
valid,
right, also on a national level.
And balance.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And reading the Old Testament is one of the things I love about the Old Testament.
Yeah, you'll get both law and gospel, and both tend to come through rather clearly. And you've got both of them in Obadiah. I think Luther once was asked about canon, and he said, "Well, any book that contains law and gospel belongs in the canon." Well, on that principle, Obadiah does.
We almost seem scared of the other side, though. I mean, you know, it's great to say we're right.
Uh-huh.
That also means somebody else is wrong.
Yeah.
It's great to say we're standing in love and in grace, but that also means somebody's standing outside of love and grace. I mean, there's always the corollary.
Right. Yeah.
Can I interject another thought?
Sure.
Seems to me that as you go all through the Old Testament, that there is a kind of undercurrent of dialectic that is always there. That you are not dealing just with those people who are obedient to God, but you're dealing with the conflict among those people for leadership. And sometimes in a writing you'll see one side of that conflict, and sometimes in a writing you'll see the other side of that conflict. And they appear to disagree. Well, they're not really disagreeing, they're just two different people looking at the same thing. And in Obadiah, I sense the Jew seeing the Edomite having been out of line. At the time of the Exodus, the Edomite looked at this Jewish horde and said, "Good heavens, we let them come through, what's going to happen to us?"
Yeah.
And they saw the Jewish people as being out of line in that setting. This doesn't mean that either of them were right or wrong. It just is the way it was. And the judgment that is pronounced is based upon how they view the situation.
Except that they were willing to make a stance, you know. It's easy for us to talk about, you know, back there. I think like when you brought in Vietnam and stuff, and this just brings forth emotions. But I think that's the point maybe where we've got to talk about it to get some of the reality of the book. And unless we can get the feeling that we're right, well, then we're all messed up. But if we got the feeling that this is a command of God, then that's what we've got to do.
But sometimes it's this wrath of God, which is the clearest way of seeing his love, because it drives us back to him.
That's the, right, that's where we've always got to end.
Yeah, I think that's Luther's main point when he talks about the wrath of God or the negative things in life.
We live in an age that likes to gloss over the bad things or likes to become paranoid and live entirely within them. And neither are right. And both deny this dialectic that the scriptures see very clearly as the way of living God's life. You know, that we always live with that tension. Nobody takes it away. Not even God. And we have to make choices within that.
And take the consequences.
And assume that the choices are right, even though they may not be.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. Now we are up to the book. Let me make one comment, then we'll move through it. The last line ends with, those who find safety on Mount Zion will go up to rule over the mountain of Esau. Dominion shall belong to the Lord. And there are many who think that John was thinking of this passage when he wrote Revelations 11:15, and which then also Handel used in the Messiah, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. Because there is some resemblance of the thought. And it closes with that thought of God having dominion over the world. All right, there are a few technical things that will have to be identified, but we'll identify them as we get to them. At the beginning, we have an introduction. Vision of Obadiah, what the Lord God has said about Edom. A herald has been sent out among the nations crying, get up, rouse yourself to fight against Edom. This is the message I got from the Lord. It's time to go out and fight against Edom, to destroy Edom. And then the next section will be concerned to explain both what will happen and why. And we have a fascinating list of 16 indictments of Edom, all beginning with the same, or virtually all beginning with the same expression. Okay. I am going to make you the least of all nations and an object of contempt, because your proud and insolent heart has led you astray. The pride of Edom is the belief that Edom is invulnerable to conquest because she lives in the mountains. The Jewish people had attempted to depend on force of arms and diplomacy in order to survive. The Edomites figure that their geography will be their natural defense and that they will survive. Because they live up in the mountains, they live in the caves among the rocks. They say, who can bring me to the ground? Well, this kind of play on words there. Who can bring me to the ground? Who can bring me down? Because I'm way up here. Even though you would soar as high, King James says as an eagle, and the New English Bible says as a vulture. I suspect they were vultures, they are not eagles, although eagle sounds nicer. But right, even though you could soar as high as a vulture, even if you had a nest which was among the stars, I am going to bring you down. This is the word of the Lord to you. And now we begin to move into the reason why Edom is going to be destroyed. If thieves or robbers had come to you at night, even though you might experience a heavy loss, now I'm sure that the Edomites knew what thieves and robbers were because those Arabs were constantly creating difficulties for them, and they were the thieves and robbers that stole from the Edomites. Even though you would experience heavy loss, they would steal only what they needed. If the winemakers had come to you, you know, the fruit pickers to pick the grapes from the vines at grape picking time, Would they not leave gleanings? Wouldn't they leave some there on the vines for the poor people to come and pick? Now, it's a reference to the old custom which they had in Palestine, that this was their relief system for the poor people. They would leave the corners of the fields unharvested, and they wouldn't pick up things that fell, so that the poor people could then go through the fields and pick up what was left and harvest what was left. Gave them something to live on, and it also eliminated waste. And so it was also custom that when you went through the vineyards, you didn't strip the vines bare, but you would leave some of the fruit there for the poor people to come through and have, so that they could make grape juice or wine also and survive. And he says, you know, what he's saying is, even among bad people, people who live by crime, and also in our ordinary customs, we take what we need. There was no need for the Edomites to be involved in this war. They didn't have to come in on the side of the Babylonians. When they came in on the side of the Babylonians, they didn't have to come up into the kingdom of Judah and plunder and loot. They'd also gone into the temple with the Babylonian armies, and they had looted the temple ware. And you didn't have to do that. Where was your humanity? But look at how Esau's treasure is going to be ransacked. His secret wealth is going to be hunted out. All of your former allies are going to force you out of your land. The people who were your confederates are going to mislead you. They're going to betray you, and they will lay you low. Even your relatives will lay a snare for your feet. A snare which is indifferent to whom it catches. On that day, I will destroy all of your wise men, and there will be no wisdom left in the Mount of Esau. Now, you can see here a very obvious reference to what had happened to Judah. All of the intelligent people and all of the politically savvy people had been carried off to Babylon. They left the ignorant and the incompetent people in the land, and that they took off the cream of the crop to Babylon. Same thing's going to happen to Esau. Yes.
There's an interesting footnote in the Living Bible, which I wasn't aware of myself. Edom was noted for her wise men. Eliphaz, the wisest of Job's three friends, was from Teman,
yes.
5 miles east of
that. Right, and Teman was the biggest city in Edom. Yeah. And there was an Old Testament time sort of proverbial saying, which you'll encounter also a number of times in the Old Testament, once in a messianic prophecy. Who is this that comes from Edom? And a kind of a praise statement, you know, indicating so-and-so must be from Edom, he's intelligent. And so if you attributed someone's to someone that he came from Edom, this is kind of way of praising him. But they're going to have all of their wisdom wiped out. This is the very word of the Lord. Your warriors, O Teman, see, there comes Teman, the biggest city in the land of Edom. Your very warriors, O Teman, shall be so feeble that every man will be cut down on the mountain of Esau, because of the murderous violence which you did to your brother Jacob. You will be covered with shame and cut off forever. Okay, now come the series of indictments. And I counted them last night. I counted 16. We'll see if, and they're not all distinct from one another. There's a certain amount of repetition to them. Okay, one. On the day when you stood aloof, on the day when strangers carried off his wealth, when foreigners trooped in by his gates and parceled out Jerusalem by lot, you yourself were of one mind with them. The day when when Jerusalem was threatened, and when the Babylonians marched in and captured the city and marched into the temple and desecrated it and destroyed it, you sat on your hands and did not help your blood relatives. At the same time, you aligned yourself with the enemy. You gloated over your brother on the day of his misfortune and rejoiced over Judah on his day of ruin. You boasted on the day of distress. You entered his people's gates on the day of his downfall. You gloated over his fall on the day of his downfall. You seized his treasure on the day of his downfall. So, two sort of ideas being expressed here. You didn't help him, you fought on the other side, and you took loot. Next one, another kind of idea now. You waited at the crossroads to cut off the fugitives. You betrayed the survivors on the day of distress. In other words, they cut off the possibility of escape to the south. And perhaps some people who fled into the land of Edom in order to escape, they were taken prisoners by the Edomites and then turned over to the Babylonians. And so for this, Edom is going to be punished. Soon the day of the Lord will come on all the nations, and you will be treated as you have treated others. Your deeds will recoil on your own head. The draught that you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations that were with you will drink continually. They will drink and gulp it down to the last drop, and then it will be as though they had never been. So the cup of the wrath of God is going to be drunk to the full by Edom and her associates. It's interesting to see that in all of these ancient great kingdoms no longer exist, like Babylonia, gone. Even their great cities are gone. I always marvel about Nineveh. There are two books of the Old Testament written to and against Nineveh. And the time that they were written, Nineveh was a city that stretched along the Tigris River for 20 miles. In the book of Jonah, it says that he walked for a day and a half and got to the center of the city. Imagine how big a city it would be, where it takes you a day and a half to walk from the suburbs to the middle of the city. Doesn't exist today. There's a big hill some distance away from the Tigris now, because the Tigris has relocated itself. But there's a big hill, and underneath that big hill is the remains of where proud Nineveh once existed. And all around it is salt-saturated dead soil. They over-irrigated it, and no longer could get foodstuff anymore. The Babylonians wiped out the Assyrians, man, woman, and child, within 80 years of the time that they became the greatest world power. Just wiped out, just like that. And no remains left. Babylonia, we have a few ruins. Babylonia left. We know where Nebuchadnezzar's palace was and where the hanging gardens were, a few other things like that. Nobody lives there. It's just ruins. But when Obadiah predicted it was going to be ruins, it wasn't ruins. It was the greatest kingdom in the world. Alrighty. Jacob. But on Mount Zion, now we have the contrast and we have the beginning of the promise and of the hope. But on Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy. Jacob will dispossess all who have dispossessed him. And we have a very interesting little image here. Then shall the house of Jacob be fire, the house of Joseph flame.
but the house of Esau will be chaff, and the fire will burn it up. And they shall blaze through it and consume it, and the house of Esau shall have no survivor. The Lord has spoken. Now I've got to give you some geography as we come to the close. They shall possess, then they shall, now they here is Judah, the Jews. They shall possess the Negev. The Negev is
in the news now.
Yeah, right. It's sure this area is. Over here. It was Philistia. It's this area over here. Whatever the sequence that he'll be doing was, then Judah will possess this, and then they'll possess this, and then they'll possess this, and they'll possess this, and all the way up here, they will come from up here and come back down here and reconquer the whole land. So it moves geographically from south to north in his images here. So they shall possess the Negev. That's the area around the curve of the Mediterranean. The mountain of Esau. That's the area down south toward Gulf of Aqaba. The Shephelah of the Philistines. That's the area between the Negev and the land of Edom. The hill country particularly. They will possess the countryside of Ephraim. Ephraim is what at Jesus' day was called Judea. That was the area that the tribe of Ephraim had. And within it is Jerusalem, Bethlehem. Samaria, which is the area just to the north of the land of Ephraim. Benjamin shall possess Gilead. Poor Benjamin, he had that territory on the west bank of the Jordan. You know, where they're talking now about establishing a Palestinian state, that was the territory that poor Benjamin had. And I say poor Benjamin because that's where the primary east-west trade routes were, and the tribe of Benjamin was always having to fight to protect their possession of the trade route area. Jericho was in that area. Gilead is on the other side of the Jordan. And so Benjamin on the west side of the Jordan is going to conquer Gilead on the east side of the Jordan. So those very important fords across the Jordan will be under their control. Exiles of Israel shall possess Canaan. Canaan was the name that at this time they then were giving to the territory that is Syria, the rest of Palestine. As far as Zarephath. Zarephath was the third of three cities that were up here. Tyre was on a little island out in the Mediterranean. Sidon was on the land, and Zarephath was there also. One of the things which Alexander the Great did when he was unable to conquer the city of Tyre in rather short order, sitting out there on the island in the bay, he built a causeway out to Tyre, and it fell just like that. And his engineers were so good that the causeway's still there, and Tyre is still connected to the mainland, and nobody has ever tried to get rid of the causeway. So Tyre isn't. The neck of land goes out to Tyre still today. So all the way up to, today we would say, including Lebanon. Exiles of Jerusalem shall possess the cities of the Negev. Those who find safety on Mount Zion will go up. And it was up, if you look at a map of Palestine, it's up to Jerusalem, but it's up even more as you get down, move down toward the Gulf of Aqaba. So they literally will go up and will hold sway of the mountain of Esau, and in that day dominion will belong to the Lord. So we get here a mixture of curse on a people who had fought against their relatives, and you also get promise of salvation which will be coming at some future day. No evidence for which exists at the time that Obadiah is writing the book. So it's written with complete faith that somehow or other God is going to fulfill his promises and his commitments to his people. I suspect that Obadiah is a very good book to read in that kind of context, when one is feeling rather low or when things aren't going very well.
just simply for the reassure, you know, to, on the one hand, to realize that, that the trespasses, even of God's people, do not go unpunished. And on the other hand, that God is faithful to those who love him. Yes.
Now, would copies, I suppose, a crude way of talking about it, would copies of this have been sent to Edom as a warning, or was this, do you see this solely as a work among the people of Israel to say, you know,
yeah, it's a poetic work that was circulated among the Jews and made them feel good in their darkest hour that the Edomites are going to get theirs. Kind of hard to answer that kind of a question. Any answer I give is pure speculation. I suspect both. The circulation among the Jewish people wouldn't be any particular problem. I suppose that, I doubt whether there would, you know, there would be formal copy formally delivered by the prophet to the king of Edom, you know, and I'm here from God and this is his message to you. At the same time, I would imagine that he would have made some effort to get it communicated to the Edomite, since it is the word of the Lord to Edom. Now, even as Jonah was to deliver the prophecy of damnation to Nineveh. And they were, you know, in those days, they were not above delivering messages to one another from the various divinities. I mean, the children of Israel got their messages from Baal, from the Philistines, you know, and our Baal, you know, says this to you people. And so this was customary, you know, to for one people to say, you know, this is what our God says to you. And so the Edomites would not have found it highly unusual to have gotten Obadiah's message. Now, whether they would have believed it or felt that, you know, it meant anything is, probably they wouldn't have been particularly impressed by it.
So you see the primary purpose is among the Israelites, even though...
Yeah, I would. Well, number one, it is, they owe it to their neighbors to deliver the curse of God. But at the same time, I suspect its primary value was to the Jews.
I would say I don't think the Edomites were particularly terrified by the curse. On the other hand, I see in Obadiah a very real optimism about the Jewish state.
Shall overcome.
Yeah. So you find a very real continuance of the relationship between the vision of the divine counsel of God and the reality of life as it is lived. And Obadiah has not moved into that apocalyptic stance, which sees victory only in terms of the cosmic action of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're coming back and we're going to do it now. Now, there are indications in the earlier verses, you know, that the Arabs and the Babylonians are going to destroy the Edomite kingdom. But at the end he says, we Jews are going to lick you Edomites. We're going to dominate you.
And 300 years later they did.
And they did, sure. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of the Edomites. And then they all became good Jews. Some by choice and some by necessity.
Who are they? Their descendants? Who are their descendants?
There are none.
There are none. They're integrated.
They're gone.
They're inbred. So they've disappeared as a distinct ethnic group.
But some Jews might have Edomite blood on their Jews.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, there's these three groups of people.
Yeah, and actually, they... from a cultural standpoint, for most of their history, they probably had a much higher culture than the Jewish people had. Much more learned and intellectual, outstanding in the arts.
Well, the archaeology of those caves is something to behold. because they, when they talk about their fortress as being impregnable, they knew what they were saying, because basically they were.
A lot of scrolls have come from there. I recall where the Dead Sea Scrolls come. Yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls come from that area. They control the area of Mount Sinai. Yeah, and there's good reason to believe that there are many more scrolls down there. All of which indicates, you know, not that you had a nomadic people living in caves who were kind of crude and couldn't read or write, but that you had a highly sophisticated, literate people who lived here for security and who had an appreciation for the written word, who maintained their personal and public libraries.
Small amount of reading I've done in non-secular scholars who are emphatically neither Christian nor Jew, say that more emphasis, they think, should be put on the Kenites, who are even south of Edom.
Yeah.
And it's felt that God perhaps first revealed himself to them, because they live closest to Mount Sinai. Have you come across that in your readings?
Yeah, the old Kenite theory has been around for a long time.
It has.
And
I only discovered it 2 years ago.
It bounces up and down in the surface of scholarship like a rubber ball.
Like the Gospel of Saint
somewhere
Thomas.
It's somewhere in between right at the moment. It's neither up nor down. There are those who claim, for instance, that the father-in-law, Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, was a Kenite. And as a Kenite, was a worshiper of Yahweh, and that the Yahwist cult then was taken over by the Jews at Sinai from the Kenites. It's a good theory. I don't know whether it's true or not.
The Scottish historian Smith is one that I read, a 19th century person, but his book was reproduced by Shockett, the Jewish publication house, recently. Yes, and when they came out of the wilderness, supposedly there were some Kenites who were friendly to them.
Yeah, well, we have come to that time, and there won't be any bell today because it's Saturday, and I don't know how the refreshment situation is.